Okay, let's just jump right in. We've got some really influential source material that a listener shared, and today we're doing a deep dive into it. It's called the CES letter.
That's right. And we're going to focus specifically on its arguments about really the foundational text of the LDS Church, the Book of Mormon.
So what's our mission here? Are we just reading it?
No, our goal is purely analytical. We're going to take five key claims from the letter claims about the text, the translation, its history, and we're going to put them right up against the published apologetic responses.
So we're looking at sources like Fair Mormon, official church essays.
Exactly. Fair Mormon, the Gospel Topics essays, and some independent scholarship, too.
Yeah.
We're synthesizing it all to see how the arguments actually stack up against each other.
And before we get into the nitty-gritty, we really need to understand the stakes here. This isn't just some old book for the church.
No, not at all. Its truth is everything. Ezra Taft Benson, former president of the church, famously called it the keystone of our religion.
The keystone. So if you pull it out.
He said, "The arch crumbles. It's that critical."
And Jeffrey R. Holland put it even more bluntly, didn't he? He called it a sudden death
He
proposition.
did. He said it's either exactly what Joseph Smith claimed it is, a divinely translated ancient record, or the whole church is, and I'm quoting here, false, fraudulent, a deception.
So there's no middle ground.
None. They set the standard themselves, so every single detail we're about to look at, it all carries this monumental weight. It either confirms the book's divinity or.
The arch crumbles.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's get into the first big area, translation issues, specifically with the King James Version of the Bible. This is where the source material gets fascinating.
It really does. The first claim is about known human-made translation errors from the KJV being copied word for word into the Book of Mormon.
And we're talking about pretty long passages, right?
Oh, yeah. Extensive sections that are identical to the 1769 King James Version. And scholars like Grant Palmer point out these aren't just, similarities. They include specific typos and mistranslations that crept into the KJV manuscripts over hundreds of years.
Can you give an example?
A classic one is 3 Nephi 12:27. The wording is an exact match for a known flawed translation in Matthew 5:27.
Wait a minute. If this is a translation by the gift and power of God straight from ancient plates, why would God copy-paste human mistakes from an 18th century English Bible?
That is the core question. It's not just the errors, it's their specific source. A divine translation shouldn't need to replicate errors from a book Joseph Smith happened to own and study.
It seems impossible to defend, so what's the apologetic response?
Well, Fair Mormon's defense tries to muddy the waters on the date. They argue, well, these errors aren't only in the 1769 edition, you can find them in the 1611 edition, too.
So they're arguing about which edition it was copied from.
Exactly. It's a very tactical defense. They're trying to create ambiguity. But their final sentence gives the whole game away.
What does it say?
They admit that all this ambiguity just makes it more difficult for us to claim with certainty which edition of the King James Version, if any, Joseph Smith plagiarized from.
If any, they actually concede the possibility of plagiarism right there in their own defense.
They do. They're arguing over a minor detail, the year of the KJV edition, to distract from the massive theological problem. The very idea that plagiarism is even on the table is the issue.
Wow. Okay. That feels like a strategic retreat. Which brings us to the second claim, which is even sharper, the KJV italics.
Yes, this moves beyond accidental errors
Yeah.
and into intentional, documented editorial choices.
Explain that. What are the italics?
So back in the early 1600s, the KJV translators added words to the text that weren't in the original Hebrew or Greek manuscripts.
Yeah.
They did it just to make the English flow better, to make it more readable,
And they marked those added words.
by putting them in italics. These are the specific, unique fingerprints of 17th century scholars at Oxford and Cambridge.
And these very specific 17th century editorial choices show up in the Book of Mormon.
Word for word, the classic example is in Malachi and 3 Nephi. Both have the exact same seven italicized words. There shall not be room enough to receive it.
That's really specific. It's like finding a modern editor's note inside an ancient Roman scroll.
That's a perfect analogy. It points very strongly to copying from a modern English Bible.
So how on earth is that defended?
The main argument is that Joseph Smith just might not have known what the italics meant. They suggest he was unaware of the system.
Unaware, but he supposedly studied the Bible his whole life.
Well, they cite research by Royal Skousen, who points out that of all the italicized words in the KJV, about 38% are changed in the Book of Mormon. Apologists see this low change rate as proof Joseph didn't know what the italics were.
But wait, other scholars could look at that same number and say the opposite, couldn't they? That keeping over 60% of them word for word is significant proof that he did know?
And they do. That's the crux of it. Plus, we know commentaries that explain these italics, like the Adam Clark commentary, were available at the time. The idea that he was just an unaware translator seems like a real stretch.
Okay, let's shift gears from the KJV to contradictions inside Joseph Smith's own work. Claim 3, the Book of Mormon, versus his later translation of the Bible, the JST.
This one is all about consistency. The Book of Mormon, as we've said, has passages like the Sermon on the Mount that were copied straight from the KJV.
Right.
But later, Joseph Smith started his own inspired revision of the Bible, the JST. And in that project, he went back and changed or fixed those very same passages.
So if God was directing both translations, why did the Book of Mormon get the unfixed version? Shouldn't the corrected, perfect language have been in there from the start?
You've hit on the exact contradiction. It forces apologists into a very difficult position. Fair Mormon's explanation is that Joseph had different purposes in mind for each translation.
Different purposes? What does that even mean?
They argue that for the Book of Mormon, changing the familiar KJV wording would have been a stumbling block for early readers.
So they're saying God or Joseph intentionally used a less correct translation to make people more comfortable.
That's the argument. They call the JST a redaction or inspired commentary, basically. A clarification, not necessarily a correction of translation errors.
But that explanation just completely falls apart when you look at how he claimed to translate, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. The source material brings up David Whitmer's account, which, by the way, the current prophet Russell M. Nelson taught in 2016.
And Whitmer said it was?
Strict, word-for-word dictation. A character appeared on the seer stone, then the English translation appeared right under it. And it wouldn't go away until it was written down perfectly.
So there's no room for different purposes.
Yeah.
There's no room for Joseph to make editorial choices to comfort his audience.
Zero room. If the words are dictated by God, they should be consistent. The fact that he had to go back and fix them later really undermines the whole claim of a perfect divine transmission.
Okay, now for a big shift. From analyzing text to hard science. Claim 4. DNA evidence.
Yes, this is a big one. For a long time, the Book of Mormon taught that a group called the Lamanites were the principal ancestors of the American Indians.
But the science is clear on this, right?
Overwhelmingly. DNA analysis proves without a doubt that Native Americans primarily descend from ancestors who migrated from Asia.
So science directly contradicted a core historical claim of the book. What happened?
The church changed the book. Around 2007, after the DNA evidence became undeniable, they altered the introduction to the Book of Mormon. It no longer says the principal ancestors.
What does it say now?
It says among the ancestors.
Wow, that is not a small change. Principal versus among completely reframes the entire historical narrative of the book.
It's a massive shift. And the church's own Gospel Topics essay on DNA confirms why. It openly states that evidence suggests that the majority of Native Americans carry largely Asian DNA. They're explicitly admitting the science forced the change.
What I find fascinating is the logistics of that. How do you roll out a global change to your foundational scripture?
Well, the source material notes that it wasn't seamless. For example, as recently as 2023, physical copies of the Book of Mormon printed in German still had the old phrasing translated to principal or main ancestors.
So the books people were actually holding in their hands were years behind the official corrected doctrine.
Exactly. It shows you the friction between making a top-down doctrinal correction and the reality on the ground. When you're forced to make a change that fundamental, it's a huge undertaking.
Okay, that brings us to Claim 5, which is probably the most famous one, anachronisms.
Right, the long, long list of things, plants, animals, technologies, that are all over the Book of Mormon, but simply did not exist in pre-Columbian America.
And the time frame we're talking about is roughly 2200 BC to 421 AD.
Correct. And the list is just archaeologically damning.
Yeah.
We're talking horses, cattle, sheep, elephants, wheels, chariots, wheat, silk, steel, iron.
Things we know for a fact weren't there.
And what's interesting is this isn't a new critique. A church historian, B.H. Roberts, was raising these same concerns internally almost 100 years ago, back in 1922.
And this list is compounded by the geography problem, right?
Exponentially. For decades, church leaders were very specific about where the Book of Mormon took place. The waters of Ripley-Onkham were Lake Ontario. The Hill Cumorah was the one in upstate New York where Joseph Smith lived.
So if you anchor the story in the Great Lakes region,
then claiming there were horses and steel and chariots there is just It's archaeologically impossible. There's zero evidence.
So let's take the most famous example, horses. How do apologists handle the horse problem?
They have to find something, anything. Scripture Central points to a very obscure study that claims to have found horse bones in Mexico that date, sort of, to Book of Mormon times.
But how strong is that evidence?
It's incredibly shaky. First, the dating wasn't even done on the bones themselves, but on material found near the bones. But more importantly, the geography. Finding horse bones in Mexico does absolutely nothing to prove there were horses in upstate New York. In fact, it does the opposite.
How so?
Well, if the apologist's best evidence is in Mexico, it suggests the early prophets who said it all happened in New York were just plain wrong about the location. The defense for the anachronism completely undermines the traditional geography.
If we step back for a second, the source material argues that maybe the biggest anachronism is the idea of the book itself.
That's a fascinating point. In 600 BC, holy texts like the Torah were scrolls. The concept of a bound book with plates. It was a much later invention. But it's more than that.
The theology.
The theology. You have fully formed Christian concepts. The name Jesus, details of his baptism, Protestant-style sermons, appearing centuries before Christ was even born. It feels like a 19th-century theology was retroactively inserted into an ancient setting.
That's a structural contradiction in the text itself.
It is.
So, wrapping this up for today. We've covered five really powerful interconnected arguments. We've seen contradictions with science, with history, and with the church's own statements.
And a clear pattern has emerged, hasn't it? The apologetic explanations often require you to believe that God chose a deliberately flawed or incorrect translation to make it easier for 19th century readers.
Or they're forced to concede that copying for a Bible was, at least, a possibility.
Which brings us to the critical question for you, the listener. The leader said this book is the keystone of the religion. We talked about the one anachronism test like seeing Abraham Lincoln holding an iPod. Just one is enough to raise serious questions.
And we're not talking about one.
We're talking about a whole volume of them. KJV errors, DNA force changes, a long list of impossible animals and technologies. So what does that volume of evidence imply about the foundation of that keystone?
That is definitely something to think about. And we are not done. We have six more key issues to get into in our next deep dive archaeology, the witnesses, and more theological contradictions.
But for anyone who wants to look at this material for themselves right now, you can just go to sansletter.org and download it. Read the claims, read the defenses we talked about, and decide for yourself based on the evidence.